All right, so now I put on my other hat, the sermon hat. And I was a little distressed at my sermon this week. I'll have to tell you, if you're looking to be uplifted and it's a joyful, happy, peppy time, you've picked the wrong series. Because it's called Unraveled, and there's just no happy, peppy way to get through unraveling. So if you go away feeling a little sad, I'm sorry, there'll be other series down the line. Many of you know I have a love-hate relationship with Facebook. I love to see pictures of my grandkids on Facebook. I think those are great. I love thought-provoking quotes, inspirational messages from friends. I love the contemplative monk. I tolerate lovely pictures of people post, some of you, of places that I wish I could go and probably never will. I tolerate mouth-watering dessert pictures, knowing that they better stay on Facebook and not on my table or I will triple in size. I'm frankly irritated that I can look at something once on Amazon and on Facebook it pops up as an ad. I feel personally violated by that. I've come to hate that Facebook has become an unsafe place where people can vent their unedited feelings and their spewage shuts down meaningful conversations rather than starts them. But that's another sermon that I have given and I may yet give again. But sometimes Facebook is instructive. Occasionally, a post will bring up something inside me that I was not aware of. For instance, pet peeves, and it just grieves my soul that James Dorward is not here today. Because I need to tell you, he does become the focus of this portion of my sermon. So thanks to Facebook, and most particularly to James Dorward, I have found that reading your comments about your pet peeves, that I have a lot more than I thought. For instance, I never knew I would be peeved by the fact that I could dive into bed at night and leave my slippers on the floor, and in the morning they're facing the wrong direction. That never bothered me before I read it, but now it does every single morning. So thank you, Facebook, James Dorward, and Kat Green, who mentioned that little pet peeve. But probably I'm too irritated. Because there's something that's bugged me a whole lot longer than Facebook. And that is picking a Bible verse, calling it your own without having a clue what it means in context. And then blaming God because the good wish of that verse doesn't manifest itself in your life. And because James isn't here, the word manifest is also one of his pet peeves. Use it. Liberally. So back to the verses in our context. Let's take a look at one of those. Jeremiah 29:11. For I know the plans I have for you, says the Lord, plans for your welfare and not calamity, to give you a future and a hope. Lovely verse, isn't it? I like it. People use it at weddings, as consolation for those in mourning, to encourage those who are destitute, to claim the new Mercedes you are sure God has promised you. It's a catch-all, use it whenever you have nothing else to say verse. But to paraphrase the Dread Pirate Roberts, you keep using that verse. I am not sure you know what it means. Now, for those of you who are Bible scholars or even Bible readers, the fact that that lovely verse comes out of the book of Jeremiah should give you a clue. Jeremiah is not known as the happy-go-lucky prophet. Most scholars believe that Jeremiah also penned the book of Lamentations, which should give you another clue. And his nickname is the Weeping Prophet. So let's read what comes right before verse 11 of chapter 29. The prophet Jeremiah wrote a letter from Jerusalem to the elders, priests, prophets, and all the rest who had been taken to Babylon by Nebuchadnezzar. This was after King Jeconiah of Judah and his mother had been taken into exile, along with the servants of the court, officials of Judah and Jerusalem, and many of the craftsmen and artisans. Jeremiah's letter began this way. This is what the eternal commander of heavenly armies and God of Israel says to those he exiled from Jerusalem to Babylon. Okay, time out. Imagine yourself as a captive of Babylon for just a moment. The consequences of the fall of Jerusalem and the deportation of the population of Judah to Babylon were devastating, as you can imagine. If suddenly you were deported from Ventura to, I don't know, Needles, it would have a consequence to you. The number of people killed by the Babylonians were in the multiple thousands. Many of the buildings in Jerusalem were destroyed, and several cities were destroyed as well. Devastation was everywhere. As a result of the devastation, the social, political, and religious life of Israel was radically changed. It forced the leaders of the nation to reevaluate their relationship with God. The people were unraveled. So when they heard that the prophet Jeremiah had a message from God, their assumption, no doubt, was that God was going to, well, I don't know, come up with Jeremiah 29:11 right then. But did he? Let's see. Jeremiah's letter goes on. Build houses. Make homes for your families because you're not coming back to Judah anytime soon. Plant gardens and eat the food you grow there. Marry. Have children. Find wives for your sons. Give your daughters in marriage so that they can have children. During these years of captivity, let your families grow and not die out. Pursue the peace and welfare of the city where I send you to exile. Pray to me, the Eternal, for Babylon, because if it has peace, you will have peace. This is what the Eternal Commander of Heavenly Armies and the God of Israel says to you. Do not be fooled by false prophets and fortune tellers among you. Don't listen to dreamers or interpretations of dreams. I did not send them to you. They're prophesying lies in my name. So says the Eternal. If you want the truth, this is what I have to say. You will remain in Babylon for 70 years. Well, if I were in captivity, and this is the message I received, I'd be pretty unhappy. Talk about dashed hopes, right? But the message goes on. When that time is over, I will come to you. I will keep my promise of bringing you back home. For I know the plans I have for you, says the Eternal. Plans for peace, not evil, to give you a future and a hope. Never forget that. At that time, you will call out for me, and I will hear you. You will pray, and I will listen. You will look for me intently, and you will find me. Okay, this last part's a little more encouraging, but honestly, if I'd been the recipient of the message, I would have tuned out right after 70 years. And whatever came after that would have flown right over my head, because 70 years is a long time. So let's take a look at the prophet. Jeremiah was the son of a priest of the Benjamite tribe. The first chapter of Jeremiah states that the Lord called him to prophesy, specifically to Judah, calling them to repentance for their idolatrous practices. Now, Jeremiah resisted the call. He was young, he was insecure, he was afraid, and he didn't like to speak. But God told him to get ready and prepare to do four things only, Jeremiah. Do not be afraid. Stand up and speak. Say what you are told and go where you are sent. Now, if we just did those four things too, our lives would be so much less complicated, but we don't. Neither did Jeremiah, but that's okay. Jeremiah was an active prophet from the 13th year of Josiah, king of Judah, somewhere around 626 BC. Until after the fall of Jerusalem and the destruction of Solomon's temple in 587 BC. Thank you, Babylonians. During his ministry, five kings of Judah rose and fell. Now, Jeremiah's fears of taking on the role of prophet were well-founded. The news God gave him to bring was not good. He condemned Judah for their idolatrous practices, for the greed of the priests, and he called out their false prophets. In fact, he became so unpopular that there were several plots that arose against him, from priests and from prophets, and ultimately from King Zedekiah himself, who had Jeremiah cast into a cistern. Now, King Zedekiah was smart enough not to raise his own hand against one of God's prophets, right? That would be bad times. So instead, he just threw him in a cistern and figured he'd starve to death, you know, and then, it's not my fault, right? But that didn't happen. Some friendly Cushites came along. They rescued Jeremiah. Now, by rescued, I mean he didn't starve to death, but he did get thrown in jail, and he was imprisoned until Jerusalem fell to the Babylonians. Now, ironically, it was the Babylonians that showed kindness to him, and they released him and told him he could go to a place that he chose. And he chose to go to Mizpah, which was back in the Benjamite area. However, any hopes of a fond family reunion were dashed, and Jeremiah continued to be unlucky. Part of his unluckiness was he was deported to Egypt, along with his faithful scribe Baruch, which is great because that is why we have the book of Jeremiah and we also have Lamentations. So good old Baruch, thank you for your service. Now, Jeremiah's career as God's prophet spanned well over a half a century, and during that time, his efforts were pretty much unsuccessful. So let's go back to the context of chapter 29. Here we see Jerusalem had fallen to Nebuchadnezzar, who exiled Judah's royal family, the royal court, high-ranking officials, and many of the craftsmen and artisans. Why? Well, the leadership folks were imprisoned in one form or another so that they couldn't lead. The craftsmen and the artisans were taken to be part of Babylon's building projects. And if you've ever followed the Seven Wonders of the World, I think Babylon's in there, so that's what they were doing. Since it's generally accepted that God lived in Jerusalem, they had been removed from God's presence. So in essence, they were a people without a God, the chosen people without a God. It was bleak, to put it mildly. And in this context, Jeremiah sends his letter to Israel, basically telling them, you might as well build houses, plant gardens, and establish families, because you're going to be there a good long time. What was your quote, Chris, this morning? It was good.
Be where your feet are.
Be where your feet are. That is essentially what they were told. For 70 years, be where your feet are. So Jeremiah goes on to say, if anyone tells you anything differently, they're not speaking from Yahweh. What God says is, you're going to be there for 70 years, get used to it, and flourish. Flourish in captivity. Easy to say. Finally, when that time is over, and by the way, most of you will be dead at that point, but God will bring you home. And in that context, Jeremiah says that God says, I know the plans I have for you, plans for your welfare and not calamity, to give you a future and a hope. Then you will call out and I will hear. You will pray and I will listen. Then you will look at me. You will find me. I'll restore you and bring you home after 70 years. 70 years. Let's think about that. Well, I'm 69. You can see, you know, I've been around a good long time, since the 1950s. And in the 1950s, there were no computers. There were no cell phones. In fact, there were not enough phone numbers available because this also predated area codes. So people had party lines where you had to wait until your neighbor got off the phone before you could make your call. Your neighbor happened to have a teenager who was in love with a guy named Jeff. It was a long time. In 1950s, there were no credit cards. Those were invented in 1951, and they weren't immediately gravitated for because people were highly suspect. Frozen prepared meals known as TV dinners were not available until 1954, and if you ever ate one, they should have waited a little longer. Cardboard. Most women didn't work outside the home, and if they did, they were either secretaries or teachers. In 1950, color televisions were available if you wanted to pay $1,250, which was upwards of $10,000 in today's economy. In short, 70 years seems like a long time ago. In fact, for most of us, it seems like the Dark Ages, doesn't it? Now remember, for the Israelites, being exiled from Jerusalem robbed them not of just their homes and their livelihood, it robbed them of their whole identity, their welfare, their proximity to God. And since they were a culture built on proximity to God, that would have been devastating. So when Jeremiah told them they may as well settle in and build homes and plant gardens in a foreign land, that was not good news. So what does this say to us? We've all heard of COVID, right? You can't go more than an hour without hearing about COVID, honestly. There's another disease, and it's a syndrome. And I need a drink, excuse me. Okay, it's a syndrome, and it affects you, probably more than you're aware of, and it can't be avoided by wearing a mask, I'm sorry to say. It is called the when-then syndrome. And if you have a medical background, don't bother Googling it. I made it up. But hang in there with me. The when-then syndrome goes like this. When I lose weight, I will be happy. When I get married, then I will no longer be lonely. When I get a raise, then I'll budget. When I retire, then I'll have time to relax. When I get a better job, then I'll be more fulfilled. When I get my schedule under control, then I'll go to church. When COVID is over, then I'll get my act together. When I get back to Jerusalem, then I will follow God. When-then syndrome, it's a killer. Why? Because it keeps us from living in the present. We're always looking for what will happen, waiting until then to really live. But life, folks, is now. This moment, we spend far too much time longing for or recovering from the past, and far too much time hoping for or dreaming of the future. But life comes sandwiched in between those two. Now look, we all need to deal with the things of our past, right? Don't hear me say that we don't. We do. And we all need to plan for the future. But we can't pitch our tent in either place. God met you in the past, but he will not meet you in the past today. God will be with you in the future, but he's not there today. If you want to meet God, you're going to have to do it now. Anything else is an illusion. So what does that say to you? Consider your current circumstances. Are you waiting for something to happen to truly live? Are you holding your relationship with God hostage, waiting for something to happen first? I read a poem recently, and I thought I'd look into its background because it was kind of an intriguing one. And I'd like to share it with you. And as I read it, try to imagine yourself as a Babylonian captive, if you can. It starts this way. If music be the food of love, play on. This is the house that music built. Each note a fingertip's purchase, rung upon rung, laddering across the unspeakable world. As for those other shrill facades, rigged for a day porticos, composed to soothe resonance of eyes, guilt-ridden, lining the parade route. Horns flash, woodwinds wail. Well, let them cheer. I won't speak judgment on the black water passing for coffee, the white water passing for soup. We supped tonight on Chopin, hummed our grief-soaked lullabies to the rapture rippling through. Let it be said, while in the midst of horror, we fed on beauty, and that, my love, is what sustained us. There's a picture in your notes of what inspired this poem. It was written by National Poet Laureate Rita Dove after she read about Alice Hertz Sommer, a survivor of the Theresienstadt ghetto concentration camp. Theresienstadt was a model concentration camp, showcased by the Nazis whenever the Red Cross arrived for inspection. Many Jewish musicians and composers were interned there. When inspection was scheduled, new clothes were issued, fresh produce was put around in fake marketplaces, and musicians played concerts. But as soon as the inspectors left, grim reality returned, including death marches to mass extermination, like Auschwitz. Even so, those whom fate spared one more time continued to compose, continued to perform for their fellow inmates. Life in a concentration camp would be unimaginably horrible. It was a tragedy that goes beyond description. One of my bosses is the son of two Holocaust survivors. And to see the impact it's had on his parents, on himself, and even on his children defies description. We see the devastating impact of slavery that continues to affect our African-American community in a profound and tragic way. There are persecutions, bigotry, racism, and discrimination going on around us, to the LGBTQ community, to the Asian community, undocumented workers, the homeless, immigrants, refugees, and sadly, many, many more. I have to think that being captured by the Babylon would have ranked along with the Holocaust. And yet, in that context, God's message was, plant gardens, build houses, let your children marry, and have babies. In other words, live. Put down roots where you are, as long as you are where you are. No matter the circumstance, if a bit of beauty, peace, or joy can be found, no matter how small or fleeting, find it. See, many of us have bought into a lie, and the lie is, if I'm good and I do what God says, my life will be trouble-free. Have you? I know I did for many, many years. And then we pull out a verse like Jeremiah 29:11 and claim it as our foundation. Now, don't get me wrong. Jeremiah 29:11 is absolutely true in its context. God did have a plan for them. His plan was to give them a future and a hope. But for God's own reason, for some extent, that future and hope meant that they'd be in Jerusalem again, but 70 years into the future. The problem is we're looking for individual verses and building an expectation on them. And in our American microwave society, our expectation leans heavily on the now rather than the not yet. And then we're disappointed and angry at God when he doesn't come through with what we think he's promised. Now here's a scary thought. What if we looked at the people in the Bible rather than a couple of verses? Because you know what we'd see? There's not one problem-free Hakuna Matata person there. Following God is not a problem-free philosophy. I'm sorry to depress you. Following God involves surrender and a willingness to be transformed. And transformation, by definition, involves letting go. It involves seeking and finding God, finding what he's up to right now, not waiting for something to happen, and then seeking and finding him. We have it pretty good, you and me. As a group, we're not currently in captivity by Babylon, for one thing. We're not in the midst of a Holocaust, nor are we enslaved. But still, many of us are in the midst of adverse circumstances. Significant trials plague us all. Several of us face things on a daily basis that make us cry out, "How long, O Lord?" And sometimes it seems like an awful long time before God answers. It's worth considering what Jeremiah had to say to Judah and see what we may apply. No matter the circumstance, are we living our lives deeply and fully, or are we waiting on hold for better days? Ben and I we've been planning probably since the 1970s to go to England. And We always, you know, we'll wait till we retire, we wait till we have enough money, we wait till this, we wait till the kids are out of the house. Finally, we decided, well, actually, someone told Ben, you know, your dream has an expiration date, which was his very nice way of saying, you guys are getting old, you better go. So on April 1st, you will not see Ben and me for 6 weeks because we are going to England, Scotland, Wales, and Ireland. And we are going to love you as we leave, but we are not going to think about you while we're gone. We're not going to have when-then syndrome any longer. Well, are we continuing to build up our homes, our families, our friends, our church, our means of employment as best we can, or are we on pause, waiting until the sun shines on us again? How then shall we live? Well, Philippians 4:8 puts it this way. Finally, brothers and sisters, fill your minds with beauty and truth. Meditate on whatever is honorable, whatever is right, whatever is pure, whatever is lovely, whatever is good, whatever is virtuous and praiseworthy. Now, Paul penned these words when he was in the middle of severe hardship. He was living in poverty. He was imprisoned. He was being beaten. He was ill, and yet in every circumstance, Paul learned to be content. There is a cost to discipleship. It involves putting everything on the altar as a sacrifice, just as Abraham did with Isaac. If we're serious about following Christ, we need to take a good, hard, long look at how we follow when the going gets tough. This series is called Unraveled. How to navigate life when things happen that unravel our expectations, our hopes, and our dreams. The lesson from Jeremiah, though, is that those very expectations, hopes, and dreams may need to be unraveled. They are not based on reality, and they lead us to a life filled with disappointment. Now, I've said before that this is probably a depressing message, and in a sense it is. But what do you really expect when the message is based on the words from the weeping prophet? But I'd like to look at it another way. We have things in our lives that we cling to that keep us from living the abundant life, that free life that God has for us. Maybe it doesn't include a Mercedes, retirement at the age of 30, or a life of a Hallmark card. For me, I want more than that anyway. I want to live the life that God has planned for me to live. Life as his beloved, following his ways, becoming more accustomed and more like him in the life I've been given to live. I want to live what I say I believe. I want to experience God in this moment, in every moment. I want to see what he's doing in and around me and join with him in that incredible adventure that many times includes more valleys than hilltops. And I can't do any of that if I'm tied to a dream of a future that may never happen, or if I'm clinging stubbornly to the days of yore. Well, I put a few questions in your sermon notes, and these are not questions to read over and answer quickly. You'll need to sit with them and really consider your answers. So the first one is, what's holding you back from feeling gratitude and joy? Second is, what dreams are you holding that need to die in order that you might truly live right now? The third is, what is God inviting you to do to live life abundantly right in the middle of the circumstances you currently face? Grace is free. But abundant life is not. The abundant life costs us everything we have. All must be surrendered to purchase the pearl of great price. It must be surrendered, yielded in order to make room for everything that God has for us. The way of abundance is always first the dying and then the rising. So look, if you're in the middle of a hard circumstance, and to some extent, I think we probably all are, it's fine to long for them to change. It's fine to ask God to rescue you and to hope that he does it soon. But in the space between now and then, don't forget to live. Don't forget to love. Don't forget to hold fast to those things that are honorable, right, pure, lovely, good, and worthy of praise. And be open to transformation because it's taking place in you right in the midst of all of this. As I close in prayer, the band can come back up. Holy God, we surrender our plans, we surrender our dreams. We trust that when the time is right, you will raise up what you raise up and it will be beautiful. Lord, we thank you that we know your presence in the midst of the valleys, that we can access your peace, your love, and your joy right where we are. Lord, meet us in this place, in this time, on this day. Be the lifter of our heads. Be the wooer of our souls. In your holy name, amen.